So tonight, it's my pleasure to welcome Mark Sosnow to Many Rivers Books and Tea for the first time. He's the author of these books here that you see. Soul of Uncertainty is his latest, as I understand it, and it is a book that he calls a fable for our times. I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say about that. Please join me in welcoming Mark Sosnow to Many Rivers.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here. And, you know, it's interesting how you end up in certain places, because this was not on my radar. And I remember how we all go through a lot of life changes. And I thought I'd say a little bit about my story and leading up to how I got here today. And then we can kind of talk about some of the book, what's in the book, which excites me because I've written other, nonfiction self-help books. And I didn't want to write another nonfiction. I wanted to write a book that not only you learn from, but you're also entertained. And there was a little bit of a mystery to it. So that was my intention, and that's how I came up with The Soul of Uncertainty. But what I thought I would do, first of all, I want to thank you for being here, and tell you a little bit about my background. Way back when, I grew up in San Francisco. I was going to be a dentist. My father was a dentist. Went to college at Berkeley. Had all this pressure to follow in their footsteps, become a dentist. But that just, I actually even went to dental school. But what I wanted to do, I wanted to be a criminal lawyer. So I went to dental school, I flunked out, I felt horrible at one level, is what I told everybody. But secretly, I was relieved. So then I went to law school, I became a lawyer, criminal lawyer, and all the things I wanted to do, I did. And I was, and it turns out early in my career I was a Rolling Stone like three times. And I did everything in the counterculture. I mean, I was like a closet counterculture person. And I remember in law school, our second year of law school, four of us rented a single engine plane and we flew to Puerto Vallarta. And right after the movie, Night of the Iguana. And I met this guy there, and he was telling me, he was a movie actor, and he was telling me about LSD. And I was going, I want to do that. I want to take LSD, but I want to finish law school first. Right? So I finished law school, passed the bar the second time, twice. And then I started out on my career as a lawyer, and it was exciting. It was really exciting early in my career. And then my life started to fall apart. What I thought was important, with career and being a celebrity and all that kind of stuff, my life fell apart. And I wouldn't call it a nervous breakdown, but like the woman that I thought I was in love with, she left, and my mother said to me, "Your heart's not broken, your ego's crushed, and that's a good thing." But it was what it took. And I used to take guitar lessons, and my guitar teacher kept talking to me about meditation. This was like in 70, 71. And I'm going, why do I want to meditate? I mean, repeat this word over and over. I mean, my life's pretty good, and da 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 da. And then when my life fell apart, I said, "Hey, Jan," I said, "tell me more about this meditation." So I got initiated into Transcendental Meditation in December of 71. And I've been meditating ever since. And I've, explored the whole psychedelic thing. And it had its place, but the meditation and yoga and Tai Chi, I've done that continuously. And then I've always played music since I've been a little kid, like since I've been about 6 years old. But I had a stepdad, and later in life, and he used to say to me, "Mark, you're quite a guy. You ought to write a book." Of course, he had dementia at the time. And that's all he could say, no matter what you were saying. That's all he would. And he had the most incredible smile. He reminded me of the character of that Peter Sellers played in Being There. He just had a his smile was so so amazing that it, you know, it was, it just, you know, you had to love the guy. And he used to always say that. And at that time, I didn't really think about that. But the year, you know, 2000 was coming up. And by then, I was, you know, I had children. I was, did well in the market. I did well in my law practice. And I started to think, what would I do if I wasn't a lawyer? So, and I always say that there are no accidents, and that I say this a lot. It's in, I think it's in my first book, and perhaps in Soul, is that I always feel like, you know, why are we reaching out and connecting with new people? Because I do a lot of that. I have a radio show called the Aspire Possibility Show. My business is called Aspire Possibility, and my radio show is called the Aspire Possibility Show. So I'm connect with various cutting edge thought leaders, and I said this yesterday. I said, you know, I feel like what we're doing is we're kind of connecting with we're gathering our tribe of kindred souls, people that are kind of have the same beliefs we do, same feeling, this inner thing, whatever it is you want to call it. And that's kind of how I kind of make sense. How do I make sense of what's going on? But anyway, so I was a lawyer, and then the new millennium's coming up, and I made the decision to stop being a lawyer. This is like pretty much late 90s, and 99 was my last year, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I was coming back from Kauai, and I used to live there with a couple of my kids, and this guy goes, I know you, you're a lawyer. He said, I met you at a workshop for lawyers, how to introduce storytelling into your law practice. And on the plane, and the 2 days before, I called a coaching school and enrolled in their basic programs. And I said, well, I haven't been on, he said, I met you at a storytelling. I said, I haven't practiced law. And he said, you live in Marin and you're a musician. And I said, well, I haven't practiced law for a year. And he said, well, what are you thinking of doing? I said, I'm thinking of becoming a life coach. And he said, well, call me if you do. I might need your help. So 3 months later, I called him. He became my first client. Then another guy called me who rented our house in Kauai. And he said, hey, I'd like to rent your house again. And he said, I see you have a new business. And he said, maybe I can use you. So then he hired me. And all of a sudden, I had this, you know, started this new business. And then I was thinking that I need to write a newsletter. So this is like, in, I don't know, 2002. Started, and, you know, I'm thinking, well, what can I say if I write a newsletter? What am I going to say? And who's going to want to read it? And so those were my thoughts, right? What am I going to say? So a friend of mine in Kauai, he was a doctor, he had in his window all these motivational quotes. So I said, hey, Art, I said, you know, could you, you know, is it possible I could copy these quotes and use them? He said, sure, let me, you know what, we'll make you copies and give them to you. So he gave me about 5 or 10 motivational quotes. And so I started a newsletter called Letters on Life, and the very first one, I copied the quote about attitude. And I remember I was in a networking group, and I read the quote about attitude to the people in the networking group. And one of them said, hey, could you send that to me digitally? And I was kind of embarrassed because I didn't know what he meant digitally. This is like 2002. And so what I did was I took the quote and I typed it out on my computer because I didn't know how to, you know, about copying and pasting and didn't know about scanning. And then I added a few sentences to the beginning and say I saw this in the doctor's office. And then I add a few concluding quotes. That was my very first newsletter. And I did the first 4 or 5 like that. And I used to, and I created a list on my, you know, email where you put a bunch of people together as a group. I didn't know about Constant Contact or the, you know, people that preceded that. So that's how I started. And I had about, so then I, you know, I continued to coach. I got invited to places to speak. And then I got this idea that I wanted to write a book. This is somebody got my newsletter. She said, you know, I see a book in you. And I said, I kind of feel that. and it was just an idea. And then my marriage kind of blew up, and you know, I was devastated. This is like about eight years ago. I was totally devastated, and I was in an independent publishing group, and so I called this guy that I met, and I said, "Hey, Joel, I met you at this meeting, and you know, I need your help to help with this book." So I reached out to him, and he said, "You know, I don't know if you have a book in you, but one thing you could do is copy your newsletters, because you have 80 of them." But I didn't want to do that, so I started my first book, and he loved the title, Dancing on the River, and that became my first book, and that was six and a half years ago. My first book came out, and I had different book events, like kind of like this. And then I had a publicist, on radio a lot, and people said, "Well, do you know what's your next book going to be about?" And I said, "Well, I just did this one. I haven't even thought about that, you know." So then I started doing the radio show, and there was one person that he was my guest. And he wrote a book, kind of what I did, where you have a person meets like a teacher, and I like that model, because it allows you to get into the realm of the fable. And a lot of people thought my book was maybe like Celestine Prophecy, or The Alchemist. These are some of the, or Siddhartha. These are some of the, or the Don Juan books. These are kind of what people have been saying about it. But anyway, I thought about all these loose ends in our life, you know, how we, you know, our life's full of loose ends, you know, we don't really know what's going to happen tomorrow. And so I thought about writing a book called Loose Ends, Learning to Love Uncertainty. That was the working title. And then I ran into Joel, the guy that helped me with Dancing on the River, and he says, "You know, it sounds like your book is a fable or fiction, and that sounds too much like nonfiction." So he, you know, didn't like the title, or didn't like that aspect of it. So I was at a party, and I was talking to this guy, and I thought he might be interested in coaching, but he wasn't. And he said, "But you're an author." And he was really impressed with that. And I told him about my new idea of a book, and I said, "But I wasn't crazy about the title, A Loose End, Learning to Have Uncertainty." He said, "You know, just anything with the word soul in it." So I said, "Oh, that's a good idea. What about The Soul of Uncertainty?" So that's how I came, you know, to this title, The Soul of Uncertainty. And it turned out in the 70s, I wrote a lot of poems, and I called it Songs and Poems for All Souls, and I had a kind of a collection of poems. But then with this book, I had an event down the street at Copperfields that my marketer scheduled, like a meet and greet. And I was going there, and I see this store, and it says Spiritual Bookstore, and I'm thinking, I should be there, not at Copperfield. So I came in here, I don't know, what, about 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago. You know, I said, "Hey, I got a new book out. Can I do something here?" And then it turns out that in the independent publishing group that I belong to, you do introductions, and this person said, "Hey, I'm interested in your radio show. Can I be on your radio show?" And it turns out his name was Mark Dupree. Gave me his book. It turns out he's the musician also. He came over, showed me his book. We played some music together. And he was the guest here. Maybe some of you heard him last Thursday. You know. So that's here I am in Sevastopol. So that's how I got here. Totally wasn't on the radar. It was just something that just happened. You know, which a lot of things in life, and so that's kind of how this book came about.
Speaking of the devil,
and he told me, right? He just right on cue, right on cue. You know.
Welcome.
Yeah. Is it possible I can have some water?
Too? Yeah, coming right up.
You know.
Yes.
You know? Hey, I was just I just mentioned your name like literally about 20 seconds ago,
man.
About how things just happened and how I met you and that. You know, and that I said, probably some of you were here last week to hear him, and they go, speaking of the devil.
Well, just that was my cue.
There it is. Now, this was not planned. Another thing that wasn't planned. So that, anyway, that's how I got here. And, you know, the idea of, of uncertainty. So you know, I was kind of uncertain what I was going to do here. What's nice about the title is that, you know, if you're not really sure what to say, you can just say, I'm really uncertain what I'm going to get, where this is going to go. So what I thought I'd do is I'd read you a little bit about, you know, the book, some of the stuff in here, and tell you a little bit about it. But what I really looked at about, you know, how do we, so I'm just curious, I mean, you want me to read some of the few passages from the book?
Sure.
And talk about, you know, this idea of how do we deal with this uncertainty in our life? And so it came up that, again, about how things are unexpected, you know, in life, how we're just living in this world of how things just, you know, we're always surprised, sometimes disappointed. But what if we had a way of handling this? So I was going to, my radio show, the guest, I don't know, the day before, canceled, you know, for my radio show. So I called the head of the network and I said, hey, Doug, I said, you know, my guest for tomorrow just canceled. And rather than just putting a show that I already did, could you interview me? And he said, sure, yeah. And he said, what do you want to talk about? I go, I don't know. Let's just wing it, because we can just talk forever, right? So we're talking, and I'm thinking, you know, I want to say something interesting. So I thought about it and really looked at, you know, what does uncertainty mean, right? And what does the word soul really mean? And I started thinking about, you know, how in the ancient, with the ancient Greeks, the Greek alphabet and the, you know, Hebrew alphabet, and the Babylonian alphabet, you know, each letter had meaning. Right, each letter had meaning. And what if we looked at the word soul? Right, this is all this spur of the moment on this radio show. I've said this now about 10 times, so not quite as spontaneous. But what if we looked at the word soul and really looked at each letter, just like they did in ancient times? And why shouldn't we really look to ancient times and see what kind of wisdom we can get out of the word soul? So that's what I did. And so we can kind of do this together. And we look at the letter S, right? So this is like when I say to people, well, how do you deal with uncertainty? Find your own soul of uncertainty. So you look at the word, you look at the letter S, and what does that stand for? So I like to make this into a game. Okay. So
it's a switchback.
Switchback, that's one guess. Okay?
Soft.
Soft. Anybody?
It's like a snake. Like a snake.
Snake?
It's a half of infinity.
Okay. But what is the letter S? So that's what you're saying the letter S represents? If you look at it as an acronym.
The shape tells you something of it.
Okay.
And that shape has been alluded to by some of the responses you've had so far.
Okay. You know, this is totally interesting because this is totally different than anywhere I was going with this. So this is very interesting in terms of what you're saying.
We're colluding.
Huh?
We're colluding.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally, you know, but that's what I'm saying about, you know, how you can have a conversation with somebody and they have a total different thing than you do.
Look at what happens when you put an S in front of word, W-O-R-D.
Oh, a word?
Sword.
Sword. Uh-huh. All right, another interesting idea. Well, it's good we're recording this because I might forget. These are like great ideas. Anybody else?
S is like a meandering stream,
mm-hmm.
And also it has a certain sound, right? As we make the sound, I think about the connection with the snake, because it's
mm-hmm.
that's kind of sound of a snake.
Mm-hmm.
Wind.
Interesting.
There's this flow with it. affirming flow describes, I think, a lot of what I've heard so far.
Right.
And it's not necessarily a directed or predetermined flow. It's uncertain.
So what the model I had, where we're going with this, is the S really represents spirit, you know, silence, stillness. That's kind of what, how I saw it is, because again, we're looking at this as a clue to how we find our own soul of uncertainty inside ourselves, right? And so to me, the S represent, you know, find spirit, find stillness, find silence. But I like where you were going with this, in terms of this other way to look at it. And any other thoughts about the S?
Well, if you start playing around with some S words, some S words may fit or make you think they fit, mm-hmm. like secret.
Right.
Could there be something hidden in those curves? Right. Mm-hmm.
So back to the curves.
Right. It's all about curves.
Uh-huh.
It's a curvy letter.
So what about the O? Let's go to the O. Okay. This might make more sense. We're looking at...
Oh, I think this made sense.
It's all uncertain. It's all in the moment. What about the O? Where do we go with the O?
Circle.
The snake has swallowed its tail.
Yeah.
We now have an Ouroboros.
Whoa. Huh.
No beginning or end.
Yeah. All right.
Surprise.
Right. So which is S?
Vowel sounds for the...
Yeah.
The vowel sounds of the universe,
yeah.
Right?
The uh-huh. What the model that I really looked at is to, you know, in the model I came up with, O really reminds us to be open. Mm. To be open to new possibilities, to new ideas. And to... really and not to let our assumptions and our judgments kind of get in the way of our looking at what's possible out there. So that's kind of how I, again, back to the model of the S, you know, we find that stillness inside, that silence, you know, and then we go to the O.
Just like to say that the O is a closed figure, so I don't go along with you on the openness of the
okay.
O, but U is definitely open to what's above.
Okay, so in the model that I have, mm-hmm. the U
like a vessel.
Yeah, right. The U reminds you to be unattached. That's how I came up with the U. Except for this model.
It's like a vessel, though, isn't it? Like a cup.
Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other thoughts?
My initial thought was just like the literal YOU. It's bringing the other into your contemplation.
Uh-huh. Right. So again, this is like a model, like a word, to remind you how you find your own soul of uncertainty inside yourself. What about the L? This is curious. Mm-hmm. Let's see where we're going to go with the L.
It's open. In the way we read, it's open forward.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something like solid here, solid base.
Mm-hmm.
Opening out.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at physical.
Okay.
Are we doing all caps or is it lowercase?
There we go.
I like caps. And I like caps.
All caps are shouting. In today's world, when you all do all caps, it's
It could be either. I don't know. You know.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. So what do we got on the book? We got.
Well,
caps.
Also in caps too.
And the uncertainty is smaller.
My daughter reminds me that if I put it all in caps, then I'm shouting. That's what she tells me. As far as texting and all that.
Yeah. That's the convention.
So the L is about love. And love includes really all, you know, our positive emotions, you know, compassion, empathy, joy, right? Gratitude, forgiveness. It really includes all of our positive emotions. And love also really comes down to loving yourself. And I think that in the work I do, what I think people forget is how to love themselves. And I tell a story. Actually, it's on my website that it came out pretty good because somebody videoed me talking about this. And I remember one time I was going through a hard time, and my buddy Duke said to me, look in the mirror, and then go, I got you, babe. Right, so that's what I did. I looked in the mirror, and I'm going, I got you, babe. And I just started laughing. And it's amazing to this self-love, right, to love yourself and to feel okay about that, because quite often, you know, we don't quite say that, you know, how important it is to love ourselves, because we can't really love others unless, you know, we really love ourselves, and to give ourselves permission to do that. So that's kind of the model that I use to say, okay, well, people say, well, yeah, how do we find our own soul of uncertainty? So look at the word, and this is the model I use, but, you know, I think that is the key, and you can look at it, you know, in the way that makes more sense to you. That kind of, but I do think it's like I say, in ancient times, each letter, you know, of these alphabets had meaning, and if we kind of look at it, you know, along those lines. So, anyway, I was going to read you a few of these passages some of the little bit of the book. Tell you a little bit about the book is that a young man meets a modern day wizard. Is kind of the premise of the story. He leaves home for the first time, and he meets this modern day wizard, and he goes. This is how it goes. The chapter is called A Remarkable Meeting. Although I very seldom remember my dreams, I did remember this one, at least some of it. A cascading waterfall close by is a giant mango tree. Sensual and vibrant scents, ginger, guava, mango, jasmine, and the most wonderful coffee. Sounds of nature, exotic birds singing their songs. I'm in the presence of a magical wizard with long flowing white hair and beard and a purple cape, who's playing a bamboo flute as he gazes up to the sky. he turns to me and says in his otherworldly voice, Sir, buddy, master, son, it is time. I sit and bite into a juicy mango. He begins to teach me about magical powers that will enable me to master life's mysteries. My eyes blink a few times. I begin to come out of the dream, not ready to leave it. The scent of brewed coffee is even stronger now. I hear playful sounds from my dog. Somewhat disoriented, I open my eyes, not sure where I am. I hear what seems to be the voice in my dream say to me, Welcome, buddy, would you like some coffee? In the same instant, I'm handed a cup of coffee. I take a sip. Perfect. But who is this person who knows my name? Is he the person in my dream? How could that be? He sure doesn't look like the person in my dream. And if that isn't who he is, then who is he? This person who has the voice of God. This person out here in the middle of nowhere. He is short, with short gray hair. He's wearing big, thick black glasses and a green baseball cap with the words, Open to All Possibilities, embroidered in black. No white beard, no purple cape. Definitely not the person in my dream. What I remember most about that first meeting was his big smile and hearty laugh. It was infectious, and soon I found myself laughing more than I ever had in my life. Before that, I hadn't done much laughing, and the coffee sure did taste good, maybe the best I ever drank up till then. You can call me Mervin, he said. When our eyes met, We continued laughing even harder. I don't know if there are such things as laughing eyes, but if there are, he had them. He continued, "Some people confuse me with Merlin, a wizard of a different era, the Middle Ages. Merlin was a wizard at King Arthur's court and King Arthur's personal mentor. If you want to, you can think of me as a modern day wizard, and I'm middle age. If you like, I can be your guide and mentor." So that's like their first meeting. And then Mervyn keeps showing up in Buddy's life. And let me just read you another passage. So what happens is Buddy eventually ends up in Big Sur. And he lives in Big Sur for 4 years. And there are lots of passages about music in here and relationships. And but anyway, Buddy hears about this alternative. He wants to go back to college. Decides he promised his mother he's going to go back to college. So he's playing the guitar down in Big Sur at Nepenthe, and then there's a place in Big Sur called Annie's Cafe. And he meets different people there. And one of the people he meets is a woman named Scorpia, which is kind of a takeoff on Scorpio, right? So from her, he hears about this alternative university, and it's called the University of the Curious. So that's where he ends up, about the University of Curious. And he takes, you know, these different metaphysical courses. And so there's one woman in the in his class that really intrigued him. And so he goes, "Celia looked different from the way she looked in class. Very different. So much so that I didn't recognize her at first. With her headband and dangling turquoise earrings, she mirrored my image of a gypsy, although I hadn't yet met any real gypsies. That made her more intriguing. She asked me if I wanted a reading. Wanting to make sure that I came off as cool and hip, I said sure, although the skeptical part of me resisted. Turned out to be much more than a reading. Much, much more. For the following 2 months, we were an item, and yes, she was amused for see how the cards are going to fall. One of my poems, one of my most well-known songs, and the one that has intrigued so many historians of that era." Now, and it goes like this. "A rainy afternoon, feeling blue, intuition told me my dream would come true. Down I went to the local cafe. There to greet me was a psychic princess, ready to play." And then there's a chorus. "Gaze into my crystal ball, see how the cards are gonna fall, gonna fall." And then the second verse, "Come on in, waiting for you to arrive, seem turned on and alive. From afar in the stars I see a love trance and romance." Then the chorus again is, "Gaze into my crystal ball, see how the cards are gonna fall, gonna fall." And then there's a bridge, and it goes like this. "Then she said, what's your sign? Is it the same as mine? If it is, you're going to have a real good time. And I said, I'm Leo the lion. And she said, oh no, I feel like dying and crying. I'm an Aries, and some people say I'm a little bit unstable. At least I put my cards on the table." And then the last verse is, "Rumor has it around town, we went around like two clowns. The romance had a chance, and just as quickly as a shooting star in the night faded into the confusion of the twilight." Yeah. "Gaze into the crystal ball, see how the cards are gonna fall, gonna fall." So that's kind of, you know, I kind of integrated some poetry into the book, and then, you know, and that was, and it turns out that how I came up with that song was, I play this on the piano now, but years ago I used to play the guitar. And there was a, when Ram Dass wrote his book, Be Here Now, you know, probably a lot of you, there was, in Mill Valley, there was this coffee house, it was called Be Here Now Cafe. So I went in there one day, and there were these two women doing tarot readings. And I had a reading, and that's, so I wrote this song called The Psychic Princess. And that's what the song used to be called. It was more like a talking blue, but it was never really developed. So when I started working with the piano, you know, my teacher helped me create it in this form. So that's how I added there. It's just again about, you know, about you know, kind of this magic in our lives. And then he goes back to Eslam where he first met Scorpia, and he meets her, and he kind of decides he needs to take a walk, and he says, as I descended further, my mind enacted a journey down a steep ravine. Thoughts of these ancient people confidently walking here and establishing this path, now time-worn, came to me sharply and clearly. While my feet were programmed by my subconscious automatic response to the twists, turns, and exposed roots of the trail, I was sinking into a thought mode, almost trance-like. I was now an Esalen native, walking to the beach for shellfish and clams, and perhaps, if graced with the power of the spirit, recipient of a fish caught on my net, which I had woven from the reeds along the banks of the Ongoth, now called the Big Sur River. The woman who had chosen me was up on the cliff, watching me descend to the beach, a half hour's walk to traverse the incline. She was quiet and strong and faithful to me. I felt a deep connection to her, an appreciation of her wisdom that was a mainstay. When I arrived on the beach, I saw the bounty of the provider, clear salt water, the rush of waves, and the abundance of birds and sea life. I looked to the sky and sent silent thanks to the Creator for this richness. My net draped over my shoulder, I was ready to cast. I knew that my knowledge of the ocean would direct me to the eddies and pools most abundant with seafood to sustain me and my tribe. Time stood still for a moment. So that's like the one scene there. And then there's a scene where he reconnects with Scorpia. And he comes back. He's had a tragedy in his life. His marriage is a little bit shaking. And he reconnects with Scorpia. And they go. She invites him to a firewalk. And after the firewalk, there are hugs. And it kind of goes like this. Well, the hug started it all again, especially the hug with Scorpia. And then the gaze into those deep and familiar green eyes. As we embraced, I could feel the cravings and sensations coursing through my entire body. The temptress inside me was back. Perhaps it had never left. Maybe it never would. It wasn't necessarily a bad thing, was it? It let me know I was alive, and it got me to think about possibilities not yet explored. Perhaps they were diversions. But wasn't I doing that already? That was kind of a little bit, you know, about that little scene there. And then there's a scene where Mervyn passes the torch to Buddy. And let me read you a little bit about that. So Mervyn comes back, they meet on Kauai, and Buddy thinks that there's a connection between this man named Harry Ramoso, who was the ambassador of the University of Curious. And Mervyn calls Buddy unexpectedly, and they meet. And Mervyn said he's on the island for a wedding. And when Mervyn finally arrived, there was the usual catching up to do, which took most of the day. I was curious about who had gotten married. Was it Mervyn's son, the son he never talked about? And why was that? As it turned out, it wasn't his son, it was Harry Ramoso, the goodwill ambassador to the University of the Curious. Apparently, Harry's first wife had died 30 years before, and it was only in the last few months that he'd fallen in love with a woman from Tahiti. They chose to get married in Tahiti for her family, and for themselves had a ceremony in Kauai, with Mervyn officiating. My initial sense that Harry had known Mervyn was correct. To my surprise, Mervyn told me they were half-brothers, with the same father and different mothers. What shocked me even more was it telling me their father was a famous artist from Spain and a friend of Picasso's until they had a falling out. Although he wasn't sure why, he thinks it was about a woman. I have to say I had a lot of fun writing this and you know where these ideas came from. It was just that idea about the Picasso thing was I was in Kauai and I was at the library in Princeville and I was working on my book there and I checked that morning I checked my email and my friend Alan he just emailed me of a photograph of Picasso and he said to me there's your twin and I'm reading this email and then I go back to edit you know that section of the book and I go oh Picasso and I just threw that in so that was kind of how I came up with that idea but the idea of the book again is to a lot of books teach and what I feel is more valuable is a book that not only teaches but entertains and I think we get it on a deeper level because we relate to the story any insights you have or questions that you want to talk about?
Your book title brings up for me the couple of notions about how life is lived, whether it's lived as improv or whether it's lived out to a plan. And do you have thoughts about those?
I think it's both. I mean, I plan things, and I think, you know, you're always improvising. I mean, all the time, you know, like we are now, and especially like when I came up, you know, with this model that I had for Soul, and you had a whole different thing about it. So I just think that, you know, and that's the whole like my first book, Dancing on the River, is to like kind of learn to, you know, you plan your trip, your river trip, but in the context of the river trip, you have to be able to flow with the river, you have to be able to flow with the current, you know, and I think that. That is like a dance, like dance. Why would dance? The title "Dancing on the River." I think we're doing this dance, and it takes planning, but it also takes to again about this model of when I really look at you know this idea of being unattached, right? Of letting go of how we want it to be, you know. And then when the Buddha talks about you know the life has suffering in it, and if we're you know attached to things that. You know, we're always going to experience the suffering, and I think that it's a matter of letting go and just kind of going with what is. And I loved improv. I mean, I just think that it's. I mean, I like to you know to make up stuff and I don't know. It's like I remember I was at my buddy's house the other night, they watch the news. I don't watch the news, right? But it's like one of the people on MSNBC. On the panel was Bush's ethics guy, right? And again, I just refused to kind of get into this whole thing. And so it's Bush's ethics guy, and they're talking to him. And he literally, I've never seen a guy talk like this. He's kind of going, well, if he thinks, you know, that he's going to scare Robert Mueller, he has another thing. Coming. And the next thing you know, my buddy and I were both talking this way like that. And we're laughing. We're just cracking up. You know, we're just on the spot. Just and I find myself and then my daughter, you know, she could be like a person on Saturday Night Live, the daughter of Elizabeth. And so she wanted to help me with my book. I gave her a copy of the book and she's very touched and I wrote something for her. Said, Dad, let me just do Instagram, you know. And so she had 40,000 followers on Instagram, you know. So she does Instagram. Where all of a sudden we're talking, and she has the book. Hey, this is my dad's book. You know, he made a great dedication to me. And she's a beautiful girl, beautiful woman. And she's going to be 30. She's a woman, you know, grown woman. She's gorgeous, and a lot of people comment about. How beautiful she is! So she has these new. She has these glasses, and the glasses are just for like stylish, right? So she's interviewing me with these glasses, and I go, you know, I feel insecure right now because you look so intelligent. You know, I'm feeling insecure. So I get up and I go get my glasses. And I used to, and so when I was a young lawyer, I used to feel insecure because I was not a good student. Right? I was not a good student. And there are these guys that are, you know, number one in their class from Harvard. And I, you know, and they look like intelligent, you know. So I got these wired glasses, kind of like you have, and, you know, kind of like you, you know, the John Lennon glasses. And I got those glasses. I didn't need glasses, but I just felt it kind of went with the persona, right? So I get up and I said, excuse me, I'm feeling insecure. I get my glasses. I put on my glasses and I sit down next to her and I go, I feel better now. Let's talk about the book. You know what I mean?
Wow.
So I do. The improv, I mean, you have to be willing to let go and not be attached, you know, to, you know, getting the last word. I mean, I think for what it is, you know, we have this attachment to wanting to get in the last word, you know. That's a great question, by the way. I appreciate that. So, you got any others?
What was the hardest part about writing the book?
That's a good question, too. Wonder if it's any good. You know, wondering about, you know, is your book any good? Especially in the beginning, because, you know, you're doing this, and you're going, like, maybe, and I wanted to do this format. I wanted to write a fable, and there are other books that were similar. And so I had, yeah, so that was the hardest part. You know, you're wondering if it's any good. And what happens is, you know, usually in the beginning, it's not that good, because you haven't edited. You're just really focusing on ideas, and a lot of people you ask to read it, they don't get that, right? They don't get that you haven't edited yet, and they get frustrated. So, you know, it's that whole thing, you know, and the whole premise of this book about uncertainty is I think all of us wonder, and, you know, starting when we're kids, and that's what I talk about in the introduction, is that the same questions that we ask ourselves that have no answer, like, am I good enough? Will I make it? Will I find God? You know, will I find love? These questions we ask in early time in our life, because my father died very young, and I wondered about God and, you know, if there was a God and how I was going to survive. And these were very real questions for me. And I think they keep coming up, you know, when we have these things. So that's the idea, is, you know, you wonder, is my book good enough? And so for me, I wondered, and then I got a really great Kirkus review, which is a major book reviewer. Wow. And that made me feel validated as a writer, you know. Because nonfiction, I think, is easier. My first two, I have a leadership book, too. I think that's easier to do, you know, than fiction, right? Because a lot of people relate to the book based on your content. But it was, and writing a fable was more fun. Definitely more fun. And the habit I got into was that I listened to Pandora. You know, I'm a musician. I have great headphones that I bought. I listen to Pandora all the time when I write. And I sit down, and if I'm stuck, I change the station. You know, I change the station. And I could go from George Winston in the same day to Ziggy Marley, you know, and John Lee Hooker, and back to Glenn Gould. I mean, all in the same setting. But that was the hardest part, wondering, am I, you know, are you wondering, well, am I wasting my time? Who's going to want to read it and everything like that? And I've been, you know, excited about doing what I'm doing. And I've never really had a hard part about talking to people, right? But the other thing about writing, I never, again, and I was not a good student in high school. I was on a team, sports team, and I was always in the band, you know. So I was not. In the high school I went to, there are a lot of, you know, guys are really brains. And then I went to Berkeley College, you know, and again I just, you know, and I joined a fraternity. These guys like play bridge all the time, and, you know, and I'm looking like, and I was young. I was 16 when I graduated, you know, from high school. So I felt a little insecure, you know, like I wasn't that smart. And I didn't get very good grades, you know. And the irony was that in English, I had to take bonehead English to get when I went to Cal, you know, before I could take English 1A. And I failed bonehead English. I had to take it again, you know. So I never, you know what I mean? So I always had that in the background, that thing, which we all have about what it could be, you know. Am I smart enough? Am I good enough? Am I, you know, will somebody love me? These questions that are unanswerable, and how do you, so it comes up, you know, it comes up in that, people critiquing your work, and you know, that you're vulnerable, and so that's sometimes hard to, you know, to put it out there, you know, to kind of show everybody your warts.
So did that kind of impede you as you were writing the book, leave these thoughts about, you know, lack of self-worth or whatever, or the worth of the material you were putting in?
Well, it didn't impede me, but it was out there. It was definitely, you know, like, you know, like, and I don't, and they, until I got the Kirkus review, I wondered, you know, and but you know, again, it, that's what it was, it's, and that's what I say in the introduction. You know, we wonder, but you know, they're always, and the thing is that let me just read a phrase from the introduction that I liked a lot. You know, I talk about these recurring questions, but what I liked, anyway, about this insecurity, what emerges is a new paradigm about living, waking up each day excited with a smile on your face, even in the midst of all of life's loose ends and uncertainty, is what real success is. In this paradigm, the shift from the physical world of accomplishment and achievement to the inner world of being and wonder has the potential to transform your relationship to life itself. It was while living on the island of Kauai that this inner world of being and wonder grew into a major part of my life. Although my circumstances kept changing and evolving, loaded as they were with many uncertainties, Mother Nature helped me to perceive these transitions in a new way. In the midst of a storm, I looked up into the sky and knew that I would see the sun somewhere hidden in the clouds and the darkness, trying to peek through. It was then that I looked for the rainbow I knew would be there. Mm-hmm. And that's why, for me, it was so important to have a rainbow on this cover, mm-hmm. you know, and the right rainbow, the way that I mm-hmm. saw it, you know. And so that was like this idea, you know. Somebody asked me, well, what is one way, you know, to handle, you know, uncertainty in life? I said, you know, it's what I call the rainbow effect. You know, it's rather than focusing on what could go wrong, keep thinking about the rainbow, that if you keep looking, will be there if you look deep enough. You know, and you don't get discouraged. You know, you don't get discouraged by the clouds and the darkness that are always there. It's always going to be doubters that, you know, you're not good enough, can't do it, or yourself. You know, you're a doubter, like, you know, am I wasting my time? What, another one is, what value does this have? You know, you really wonder, what value? I did that a lot as a lawyer, especially later in my career, and that's why I shifted, because initially I felt purpose. That's another thing the book talks about purpose, finding our life purpose, and what fills us up at one time in our life doesn't later on. You know, early was save the world. You know, later was being a dad, having a family. You know, and then it keeps changing. So this idea that that again, all these life concepts through the characters, that's what was fun about it. Make characters that, a lot of feedback I get from people is that the characters are easy to relate to. If you look at some of the reviews on Amazon and some of the, you know, dance praise for the book, and that's what people say, the characters are, you know, and I think through characters, it sticks with you because you can relate to the character and get their message. I could read more, but hopefully you buy the book and I'll sign it. And Dancing on the River, and so any more great questions?
I've got one, and I apologize for not being here earlier because you may have answered it. I'm really interested in the process of writing. I've done a little bit myself, but one of the things that I found when I was writing fiction, which is a whole different thing, that I found that I would dream about what was going to happen next, and the characters would talk to me. Wow. It was a very intuitive kind of a wild thing. Did that happen to you? Did you get an intimate relationship with the cast of characters?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like I used to, you know, it's interesting because I just chose for the, you know, for the mentor, Mervin, who happens to be the same name as my uncle, you know, because it rhymes with Merlin. And I wanted to, you know, and earlier, you know, I read that scene where he meets Mervin and he says, I'm a, you know, modern day wizard. Some people confuse me with Merlin. And, but yeah, the characters start to have a life of their own, you know, like Buddy and you know, Mervin, they're really, really, you know, they're just, you know, my voice and through characters. Otherwise, you know, you just have a to-do list, you know, well, the 10 things you do to overcome uncertainty or boom, boom. I didn't want to do that. And a lot of the book is about, you know, finding joy, you know, how to live a joyous life and people to remind you to do that. And what's fun is, too, there's a character in the book named Edie the Astrologer. Mm-hmm. And she was like a real person in my life, you know. And how I met her was the most bizarre circumstances. And, you know, I've had a lot of bizarre circumstances. I could be here all night talking about them. Yes, you had a question?
We're in a paradigm that overvalues knowing and undervalues not knowing. And yet the relationship between the knowing and the not knowing, it's like, it's very important. Because it's kind of like water turning into ice and the ice turning into water, that back and forth thing going on. And so it's like maintaining the uncertainty and the gift of honoring that uncertainty is every once in a while this certainty kind of just jumps out and takes you by surprise. And you don't know where it came from, but you know it's a gift. And
I mean, that you're talking about certainties again?
Well,
the knowing.
Actually, they're both a gift. Yeah. They're both a gift because because we're swimming in mystery. We're in mystery.
Right.
Nobody knows really what's going on here. Or how we got here. But it's the overvaluing that knowing in the school systems. You get graded on what you know, and nobody says anything about how important it is to not know.
Right.
You know, and if you don't know, then you're associated with being dumb. And so you find out, hey, sometimes I get to pass myself off as not being dumb.
As not what?
Not being dumb.
Uh-huh.
As knowing something.
Right.
Hey, I know something. And it looks like people are buying into it.
Right.
But I think what it all comes down to is I think being able to tell a good story, have a good conversation.
I agree.
And feeling your soul present.
Absolutely.
In the moment.
Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting? Talking about knowing and not knowing, Dancing on the River, the book has 8 principles of navigating change. So when I would give talks about getting on the positive side of change, I'd have these 8 principles. And I'll just say quickly, one is live from your center. Second one is be grateful. Third one is be curious. Fourth one is to be prepared. Fifth one is getting out of your comfort zone. The sixth one is letting go resistance. The seventh one is to be connected. And the eighth one is to embrace what you're talking about, the great mystery. You know, even though we have this game plan, you know, life is a mystery. We get things unexpectedly. And that's, you know, like, so there's this idea about not knowing and certainty. You know, what's fun about writing about you know, a book about uncertainty is that someone asks you a question, you go, I don't know. You know, and I totally agree. And I become more comfortable when people talk to me saying, you know, I'm not sure. I'm very comfortable saying I'm not sure how I think about that. Mm-hmm. And I just, but you know, if even when, you know, even when I was a lawyer, I never was absolute. You know, I said, look, I don't know, you know, this is what I think is going to happen, but anything could happen. And I think that's what I've become, you know, more comfortable with, is the not knowing, that to what you said about, you know, to enjoy each moment that we have and to, you know, be present and to flow with what is. I mean, all these things we've been talking about. And, but, you know, you get to, I think one thing about, because it's like, I would say here, I can honestly say, there's nobody here under 30. Maybe 40, maybe even a little higher, you know, 50, you know. But as you, I think the nice thing about getting older, also about suffering, I think that, you know, the thing about suffering is, I think what happens, it, you know, to allow yourself to suffer and to face your insecurity and your pain also expands, you know, as you expand your ability to allow pain in, you also expand your ability to experience joy. And I'm a firm believer of that. And I think that as we get older, you know, that's what I find is incredible. You know, and I interview some amazing people in my radio show every week. And almost everybody says that. I interviewed yesterday the president of the University of Maryland. And we got talking about, you know, what we're talking about now. I mean, he was like, in Time Magazine, he was the most 12 influential leaders in the world in 2012. And all of a sudden, I said, what are your biggest challenges? And he said, well, professionally or personally? And I said, you know,
personally.
I said, both. I said, I don't know, let's do both. So he talked about professional challenge. What about personally? What he said was work-life balance. And I said, well, how do you handle that? What's your strategy? He said, have good hobbies. And I said, for example, he said, well, I like to play piano. And I go, oh, I happen to play the piano. You know, and then he goes, I like to play tennis. I go, I play tennis. You know?
Oh, wow.
And it was amazing how we went from that level. And it was just, you know, it was such an exhilarating conversation. And I think to let go of our differences, right? To let go of our differences and really to focus on, you know, what we all have in common, what we all want. And I think what we really want, I always talk about it like, I think what everybody really wants is to feel connected.
To feel connected.
And I think people don't necessarily know how to do that. And so it's kind of one of the missions I have is to help people how to communicate on a deeper level. You know, and I think the key, what I know about you know, this ability to know what people really want is to connect. And the key to that is to really listen, but not just to the words, but to their, you know, to their whole being and their feelings. And then to realize that to have that ultimate connection is you have to be willing to take responsibility, to really take responsibility, to go there, to reach out, and to realize that it's like a lot of things, it's an art and process. And, you know, and the other thing about happiness is I've had two people that are, you know, one person was a Nigerian man. He was honored by the United Nations for his work on happiness. His name is Edwin Edeberry. And he has an I Am Happy project. And he talked about happiness. He feels that it's a skill. It's a skill set that you develop. And another man that I interviewed recently, He said the similar thing. It's a choice. And I used to have on my voicemail, happiness is a choice. And then I had that for a number of years until some of my friends begged me to change it. You know, they just got tired of it. They didn't like, so I changed it to, you know, stay curious, right? And to realize that happiness, I always say now, it's a better option. Because we do have a choice about what happens to enjoy ourselves. Back to, you know, what you were saying about coming down to embracing each moment. To just feel, hey, this is a blessing, you know, to be here and to share ideas and to, again, gathering our tribe of kindred souls. And that's what I feel like I'm doing, you know, the work I do in my radio show, speaking to people that I've never met before, and coming to a, you know, great place like Many Rivers. And what I thought was interesting, and I didn't even think about this, to be honest, until I brought my other book in today, and
Dancing
I'm thinking,
on the river.
Holy cow, there's
Many Rivers.
Many Rivers, Dancing on the River. You know, what a great advertisement for this store. And but it is, you know, that sense of wonder, you know, that we lose because life can sap us, you know, can be hard, and it can sap us, you know, and you have horrible things happen to you, and I have. But it's like, you know, you go on and you realize, you know, each day is a blessing, and to just be grateful for what is, you know, and I feel that way every day. You know, getting a chance to connect with you. Any other questions?
Could we have a plug for your radio program so we get on the recording?
Yes, you can. The easiest way is just go to my website is inspiredpossibility.com. I have cards here, and you / Inspire Possibility, my show will come up, and it's the Inspire Possibility show. It's a podcast too on iTunes and Stitcher, and you can just Google the Inspire Possibility show. And I had John Gray on my show, you know, a few months ago, and Mark was on my show a few weeks ago, and we talked about, what do we talk about? Mysticism.
Yeah, mysticism.
Talk about the piano.
Yeah, piano.
Piano keeps coming up.
Trees.
You know, yeah.
Are you out of Marin? Out of Marin?
I'm out of Marin. Yeah. And you had a question.
Well, I just wanted to comment about wonder. I do a one-woman show about Rachel Carson, and she wrote a book for children about, to encourage adults to teach their, to help encourage their children to continue to wonder, because a sense of wonder is one of the most important things that we can have. And, you know, it was her sense of wonder about the world that led her down the path that she took. It's just so important. And I think it's easy for parents to think that their children need to learn this and learn that and be very much more rigid than just going out and sitting in a field and looking up at the sky and saying, wow, this is wonderful. How does that happen?
Yeah. No, it is. And we lose sight of that. I mean, it really, we all have issues, you know, stuff that concerns us, and, you know, and that sometimes just gets in the way of our, you know, that's why I think back to my model about finding your own soul of uncertainty, that, you know, about remind the word soul, you know, find that stillness, you know, remind yourself to be open and not let go of assumptions and judgments. And to open to new possibilities and not be attached to having to be a certain way. I think that's huge, you know, how we want it to be a certain way, and if it isn't, you know, we're devastated at times, and to go, okay, plan B. Okay, I'm going with plan B, and a lot of times, you know what, I find plan B is better, because it's like, and to wonder, you know, and what I do, which I think is a great practice. You know, not only do I meditate in the morning, but after I meditate, I always focus on what I'm grateful for. But I look at gratitude in a different way. I mean, all the spiritual teachings talk about being grateful. It shifts your focus from, you know, what you don't like about your life to what isn't working to what is good and what you like about your life. And what you can do is and I suggest to people, you can take a quality about yourself that you want to work on. And I do this a lot in my workshops. I say, okay, like somebody said, well, you know, I don't really feel I have any close friends. So that's their belief. And I said, you know what? Be grateful for your ability to connect with people. And they go, well, wait a minute. You know, I don't really connect with people. I just said I don't. But at some level, you do. And be grateful for that ability, you know. That ability you have, whatever it is, and you start to focus on it, and you start to notice, you know, I'm actually a good connector. And you start to notice it more and more, you know. And you can do that with any quality you want to kind of up the ante on. It's a great practice. So that's, you know, I do. So I focus on what I'm grateful for every day. I don't focus like a lot. I mean, maybe 10 seconds, 20 seconds. And I used to have a gratitude list. But the other part of my morning program, which I think is you know, I feel like I kind of, you know, thought about this when I first got in, you know, this phase of my life, is to really wonder about the highlight of your day. You know? So I think I'd like to end this in a certain way, this workshop or this talk. Or first of all, I want to encourage you to buy both books to support the store, and more the store than me. I don't make a lot of money doing this, but it'd be great to do that. And I think you'd really enjoy them. And I think soul, like I say, be entertained. But the highlight of the day, it can be in a meeting, it can be in an event about what your highlight was, and it gets you. So if you start your day meditating, right, again about the S, about silence, stillness, you know, and then focusing what you're grateful for, and then you go, I'm curious what the highlight of my day is going to be. And I do that every day. Who I'm going to meet, so when I go any place, I go, I'm curious what the highlight's going to be, you know, and let's end it that way, okay? Everybody just, you know, go around the circle. And again, somebody asked me about planning and improv. I'm improvising right now, in case you're trying to wonder, okay? Just go around what the highlight is for you of tonight.
I was just at the Barlow at their Thursday night market, and there was a woman there that blows bubbles. Mm-hmm. She has one of these great big wands, and she blows bubbles. And there were all these little kids just running around chasing the bubbles and trying to pop them. And that was the highlight of my day today, mm-hmm. watching those kids play.
All right, thank you.
Oh, I like what you said about that we're all seeking connection. But that was.
Thank you.
I had a lot of highlights.
You smiled a lot. I like that. Then you know you're talking about like wondering about is any good. I go, he likes what I'm saying.
I had two highlights. One was an improv conversation this afternoon with another customer of the store on the subject of astrology. The second one was this event this evening. Well, unexpectedly enjoyable.
Thank you. Thank you. Linda?
Fun to come down here, Mark, and see you in this venue. And then I sat in my friend Lita's garden and communed with nature spirits.
The highlight for me today was for my next book, I've been waiting for a university to grant me permission to quote a section from a book they published. You know, like, and I got permission today to do that, so I can go forward with the book.
Awesome.
I think I have two. The first one was talking to my younger daughter, who lives down in North Hollywood, and she like my older girl, they're aspiring actor singers, and it's a hard business. But she's doing some real brave stuff tonight, and she inspires me. She inspires me a lot. So always talking to her, almost every day we talk, and it's always a highlight for me, both in terms of what we communicate about and how she inspires me. And then the other one is I just love this too. You know, really. I've never thought of that in the morning to think about, to be curious about what the highlight of this new day will be. So I think that was a real highlight for me.
Good. and I was going to say that sort of through the dialogue in the book, the character talks about this, like Buddy's mentor, Mervin, talks about, you know, the highlight and all this kind of stuff. So I did it rather than a to-do thing, like a character form. Mark?
I had my band jam tonight, and the rhythm section, the pianist and the guitarist did not come, so it was on the drummer and the bass player had to be the rhythm section, and it's a lot harder, but it was really good. I had a lot of space to fill, and I filled it, and so it felt really, really cool that I was being played, and it was a very graceful feeling. So it was almost like when the fact they didn't show up, I was like, oh my God, it's going to be horrible, right? Mm-hmm. And it was actually really, really cool. So that was a highlight.
All right.
So today a bunch of things sort of fell into place with plans for regarding the store and my personal life for the next few weeks. And so I was just being in the store earlier today, holding all that those generous gifts from the universe.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Right.
I had two big things happen today. One of them is I found out I don't have to have a knee replacement for at least a year. Mm-hmm. So some of you of a certain age will appreciate that. And I got to spend time with my dear old friend Linda. I was just doing the math. It's been like 44 years. And lifetime.
That you've seen her?
No, that we've been connected. But just, I appreciated the ability of being connected with somebody where it wasn't like a week had gone by.
Right.
It's been like months. But just that joy of connection.
All right.
It's just so beautiful.
Thank you.
Well, in my religion, pointing to some other moment during the day than this one here is just against the law. So you're all in trouble. Big trouble.
Every moment is the highlight, huh?
There's only one moment.
Does that mean we're heretics?
Oh, it's much worse than that.
Damned. We're all going to hell.
Yeah. All right. So, thank you for sharing that. And it's a little bit about what I do. I do like coaching, and I do a lot of one-on-one work. I do workshops, and in my books, I have a newsletter that I write monthly called Letters on Life. And you know, when you sign up, you get a couple of e-books, and then I've been writing the letters now for about 17 years, I think, because I'm up to 170 once a month. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them went into Dancing on the River. I just, edited that. But I'm in the process today of writing my June newsletter. It's going to come out tomorrow. But if you want to, sign up for that, I have a sign up here. You can sign up there. Sign up for mail or give me your card. A couple of cards here. And if you want to get one of the books, I'll be glad to sign it and personalize it. All that kind of stuff. So thank you to Many Rivers for having me.
Thank you. So many of you know the drill. Odin will shortly put out a donation bowl right over there. We encourage you to contribute to it. We split that with our speakers to further their work and also to maintain this space for further such events. And of course, Mark was very good about pointing out that there are two books over here that you can purchase, and by all means feel free so to do, and thank you all for coming tonight. Very much appreciated.
All right.